Welcome to your own health and fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman, and I come to you weekly to discuss self-care and the art of healing. Stimulated by the current political tone of this country, people are thinking about taking action, daunted by the aspect of taking on one more thing. And feeling discouraged and helpless, many are opting out of getting involved. I'm reminded that during the Dark Ages in Europe, the feudal system fell because it was replaced by the economy of the villages that grew up in the shadow of the castle. Eventually, the castle came to the people for goods, and there was a dominance shift. Grassroot community action. Here's a model for how to solve many of society's inequities. While we wait for the government to change, too many people will continue to go without health care, nutritious food, safe and healthy living and working environments. Join me this hour as I interview Leslie Michelson from the Prevention Institute. Their work is described on their website, links practices from public health, education, urban planning, social work, and other fields so that communities can create conditions for healthier living. First, an editorial about this week's health news by Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett.
Thank you, Lena. What's an autistic child worth? The EPA has an answer. It's the income the child won't be able to earn in his or her lifetime because of autism. This neat calculation was used recently by the EPA in setting how severely it will regulate mercury emissions by power plants. Less mercury in the environment leads to fewer children with autism. Announced 2 weeks ago, the EPA aims to reduce mercury by 50% over the next 13 years. Using risk assessment, the EPA estimated the health benefit of prevented autism to be $50 million. But the cost to industry was estimated to be $750 million. By the rules of risk assessment that the EPA and other agencies eagerly use, this regulation shouldn't be put into effect. The cost far outweighs the benefit. By the rules of risk assessment, the burden on industry should be lightened and more mercury allowed into the air. But the power industry, no doubt out of a selfless concern for public health, took a deep breath and signed on to the regulation. Then last week, the Washington Post revealed that the EPA ignored a study it had commissioned that found the health benefit to be not $50 million, but $5 billion, 100 times greater and 7 times the cost. By the rules of risk assessment, we should control mercury much more heavily. And so, a catfight breaks out over whose number is right. The EPA's method for achieving its goal, whatever it may be, is called cap and trade. The EPA sets limits for each company, the cap. Some companies will emit below their limit, some above it. Those that spew more mercury will be able to buy permits from those that spew less, the trade. Wait a minute. This is a setup. The EPA and the media are telling us that the controversy is about how much mercury the government is going to permit business to dump into the air and ultimately into our bodies. Why don't we call this what it is? The EPA is deciding on the number of autistic children who will be born, and power companies are buying and selling those autistic children. The setup is in the system. Risk assessment starts from what industry wants. The burden of proof is on us to show why power companies shouldn't pour as much mercury as they want into the air. We need a system that enables us to ask, which energy technology causes the lowest incidence of autism? That's what the EPA would ask if it used what's called alternatives analysis and the precautionary principle instead of risk assessment. Look at Mary O'Brien's book, Making Better Environmental Decisions, and the website for the Environmental Science and Health Network, www.sehn.org. Let your national, state, and local representatives know you want agencies to use alternatives analysis and the precautionary principle, not risk assessment. For your individual protection from mercury, look at the website for the Environmental Working Group, www.ewg.org. I'm Jeffrey Fawcett. Take care of yourself.
Thank you. That was marvelous. Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett is a political economist, a writer, and health strategies advisor who works with me on the Progressive Health Observer, a news commentary alternative to big box medicine. In addition to his work on the newsletter, he works with people making healthcare decisions. You can reach him by going to the consultation link on our website, yourownhealthandfitness.com. Now let's get to our interview with Leslie Michelson, director of the Prevention Institute. She develops new programs and strategies to place prevention in the center of efforts to improve community health and well-being. A key emphasis of her work is on systems approaches to promoting healthy eating and physical activity. In this capacity, she provides training and facilitation for local and state coalitions and has authored research papers for the California Endowment and the Robert Woods Johnson Foundation, outlining strategies for shifting community environments to support healthier behaviors. She coordinates the Strategic Alliance for Healthy Food and Activity Environments, a network advocating to make healthy eating and physical activity options more accessible in California. She also serves on the Kaiser Permanente Food Policy Steering Committee and is co-coordinator of the Healthcare Without Harm Food Work Group. Before joining Prevention Institute, Leslie worked for the Alameda County and the New York City food banks, where she directed programs designed to address hunger and mobilize community advocacy to support anti-hunger policies. She's a registered dietitian and received her Master of Public Health degree from the University of California in Berkeley, and we welcome her to the show today. Welcome to you.
Thank you so much, Lena. I'm glad to be here today.
We're glad that you're here as well. Well, I have to ask first, how did an organization dedicated to prevention in populations at risk get started?
Well, it was really the vision of our executive director, Larry Cohen. He had spent many years working in Contra Costa County. He created one of the first prevention programs for a public health department in the country, and through that experience really became clear that there is a methodology to prevention, that if we really want to create communities that support health, we have to not only give people knowledge and information, but we really need to change the practices of organizations and put public policies in place to ensure that people can access healthy options and that the toxics, as Dr. Fawcett was describing, are not being spewed into our environments.
The reason I wanted you on the show, as I talked to you a bit about this yesterday, is that I want people to have a tangible model for how change occurs in this country. I believe that change occurs at this grassroots level. So the reason I was interested in how you got started is that I'm imagining that people across the country who may hear this show will want to know, you know, and we can talk about it as the show progresses, how one can get involved and how one can start a community-based program, what it would involve. So we'll get into that. Now part of what you are addressing is disparities in access to health care, healthy food, good wages, clean environments. Who is your population?
Well, yeah, let me describe that a little bit to you. I mean, our focus is on primary prevention, and that really means addressing injuries and disease before it occurs. So our focus is actually before health care is needed. What we're trying to do is, as much as possible, minimize the number of people that need health care by putting into practice all that we know about disease prevention. And I think just as the description of mercury and autism and sort of the unwillingness and the lack of political will to prevent something we know we have the power to prevent, we see that across a range of health issues. One of the areas we have really focused on is thinking about, why do we have such incredible inequities in health outcomes between the white sort of middle and upper middle class and people of color and people with low incomes? And so we sat around and we did an analysis looking at the research literature, and it became really clear that at its fundamental roots, people are experiencing oppression, they're experiencing institutional racism, they're experiencing the pressures of poverty. But those are manifested in very clear ways in communities. And it's those ways it's manifested in poor education, in lack of mentoring and social support, in the fact that neighborhoods don't have healthy food options and don't feel safe for kids to play out on the street. If you start to look at all those factors, it's really no surprise that there's this differential in health outcomes.
Well, it's also the case, I believe, that if you're in danger of being shot on the street, or if you're likely to be imprisoned, or in prison, in fact, or if you are a family without a parent because of a prison situation. I mean, I think I mentioned to you that I was chatting with a girlfriend of mine who's African American, and we were talking about the stresses that we were enduring, and one of her stresses is that a good friend of hers is helping another friend who is in prison and due to be released after 30 years of being imprisoned for something that he apparently didn't do. But the home security, the Patriot Act, is preventing him from being released for no apparent reason other than the fact that he's a person of color. So there are levels of stress that are really quite different in different societies. This is, despite the veneer that we have in this culture, this is still a classist society.
I agree, and there's actually some great research that's been done to sort of put some data behind what I think people of color know and poor people know they're experiencing in this country. Arlene Geronimus has written about the weathering process of being an African-American woman, because it's constant. I mean, I worked in for the Alameda County Community Food Bank, and many of my colleagues and people in the neighborhoods, I mean, every week something different happened to a family member. I mean, it might be that they had a diabetic incident, or that they had a heart attack, or that their nephew was shot. I mean, this creates an incredible sense of stress. And I mean, I think no one knows better than you. And of course, you help people on an individual level to try to overcome the impact stress has on your body. But if we don't do something about those external factors, we know that there's just too much happening, that we can't be successful in preventing disease strictly by an individual approach. We really need to look at the whole community and how we create a society that supports health. And that's what we've devoted ourselves to, is thinking about how to do that.
One of the major stressors that people are exposed to is the toxics in their environments. I mean, we all know that there are areas in, certainly in California and in other parts of the country, where people who have lower income, people who have low rents, are living on toxic dumps, on areas that have not been cleaned up properly. So there's been a terrible problem in terms of putting enough pressure on you know, opening up these areas for people to live. The other thing, of course, as you know, since you're talking about the research on stress, is that stress can cause people to develop something called learned helplessness, which is not just a psychological problem, it actually becomes a physical problem, because if people are hopeless, they give up the will to live, and they're not able to take care of themselves anymore. So what we're talking about is institutional racism and how it contributes to make people helpless. So, and I know that you have a list of areas concerned, and one of them is the built environment. And since I just brought up this problem of pollutants in the environment, I know that your concern is primarily, as a prevention institute, partially on enabling people to have access to being able to bicycle or walk or get exercise in the process of doing what they need to do. And that means they have to have, for instance, a store that sells food walking distance or biking distance.
Right.
But does it also include this issue of toxins?
Oh, of course. I mean, I think if you look at the factors, I mean, as you mentioned at the beginning of the show, a lot of my work is focused on physical activity. But I actually think what's great about thinking about what makes it possible to be physically active is that it connects to so many quality of life issues in a neighborhood. So, of course, it has to do with having places in your neighborhood to go. But it also has to do with the quality of the air. I mean, if the air quality is bad, and we know rates of asthma are higher among low-income kids than kids of color, they're not going to be able to go out and get the physical activity that we're recommending on a bad air day. And, of course, if there's actually a factory or a plant in their neighborhood that's putting out toxins, then their risk is going to be even higher for exposure to that.
Okay, so how does a small organization like yours, which you have a private funder, is that what you have?
Well, we actually have... Yes, we have support from foundations. I mean, we're very lucky here in California because the California Endowment is really taking an innovative approach to promoting health. And while many healthcare funders have traditionally focused on supporting the healthcare system, the endowment has also recognized that there really has to be environmental change. There has to be community change in order to protect health. So we've been lucky to have their support. And we actually do work with communities across the country. Right now we're going to be doing some work in the state of Washington where they're bringing together local people working on tobacco control, alcohol, injury prevention, nutrition and physical activity promotion. And we're going to be sharing with them sort of the methods of transforming communities. And I think I kind of alluded to that before, that our methods are fairly straightforward. We use a tool called the Spectrum of Prevention. And this really came out of praxis. I mean, based on Larry Cohen's work, he was trained as a social worker in how to mobilize communities. And what he found was that it was important to impress upon people the need to work on all levels. And so not only the educational level, but to mobilize coalitions and to then use the power of that coalition to make simple changes. I mean, you can really just start at a very local level in the organizations that are there. And I'll just give a little example.
Please.
From our own organization. I'll start very small, because one thing we have that's really exciting is that every week, and today was the day, we get an organic fruit box delivered to our office. And that has made such a difference in, frankly, what we as staff eat, because now we have this lovely fruit that we can all access. It's originally we chipped in for it, and then we decided as an institution that we could afford to pay for that box every week. So that's just an example.
Well, forgive me, but, you know, what I'm really interested in is we're talking about issues that are so overweening and so overwhelming to both the people who are living in the situation and people from the outside who want to help, that I'm wondering, beyond your office mm-hmm. getting supported,
right.
how the greater environment around you in the community is getting help, particularly in these areas, for instance, like we just said, of the built environment and of pollutants in the environment. Because, you know, no matter what you do to prevent getting sick, if you're exposed to really dangerous pollutants like lead, for which there is no safe allowable level, and it's very difficult to get out of your body, even if you have lots of money and go to an alternative doctor who knows how to chelate out metals, the people that live in these communities are stuck with this. So that's the first, it seems to me that's one of the first areas, is not only to prevent them from being jailed or killed on the street and having good food, but protecting their environment. And I realize that you don't work in every area in the Institute, but if you could give us an example of how the Institute interacts with the community to put pressure where it's needed, that would really be helpful.
Sure. I mean, we have not... There is actually a fabulous environmental justice movement out there that has been working on getting toxics out of neighborhoods, and that has, therefore, that has not been something we have actually...
That's not one of your... Okay.
...as an organization. But I can give a different example, which we do have a long history working on violence prevention. And we have been working with Alameda County to develop a plan, a strategy for how we're going to reduce violence in the community. And I, let me give the caveat that I personally don't work on that project, but it really began with some top leadership in the county, Supervisor Nate Miley, and leaders in the health department and in law enforcement, getting together and starting to think about who's going to take responsibility for violence prevention and how are we going to create... get the community involved in taking a stand. And I think that what's important about these kind of community mobilization efforts is that they take time. You know, they take a combination of kind of hearing what people feel is going on in their neighborhoods and what they'd like to see changed, looking at where there is opportunities to look at what's maybe happened in other communities and what's been successful to incorporate that, and to really have a strategy. And I think that to have that vision of a direction you're going is, and then to engage people in shaping that vision, has been what we've found works in community after community.
So can you give us an example of how, I mean, again, I appreciate the fact that you're speaking, you know, this is not your area of expertise, but you are the managing director of the group. So what kinds of things is the Institute doing to interact with the community to help them with that? You're just creating resources for them?
Well, and we work a lot with groups that do grassroots organizing. So, for example, with our Strategic Alliance for Healthy Food and Activity Environments, we held some meetings, some listening sessions to hear what people thought were sort of the key priorities for improving eating activity environments, and we've incorporated that into a document, Taking Action for a Healthier California, that we are now asking groups to endorse so that we can send that to the governor and his administration. They've made a very strong public statement that they're concerned about poor eating and inactivity in California, and that they really want to do something about it. So we wanted to put on paper the kinds of actions that they can take. And that's what our platform is about. And while we're doing this at a statewide level, also at a local level, community organizations are doing the same thing. They're mobilizing and saying, you know, we are tired of seeing junk food in our schools. There is no reason that this school should be open game for the food industry, and they're starting to set regulations in place. San Francisco has an anti-commercialism policy, so there's no advertising or marketing allowed in the schools. Oakland Unified School District passed a junk food ban, so they've been taking out sort of some of the higher sugar and high-fat foods. And it's through making those kind of changes that we can have a real difference in what kids are encountering every day in their lives.
You're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman, and I'm on the phone with Leslie Michelson. She is the managing director of the Prevention Institute. We're using them as a model for community organizing throughout the country. This organization, the Prevention Institute, is in Oakland, California, and their website is preventioninstitute.org. I recognize that your area of expertise has to do with a diet and exercise, and I want to sort of tie this in with violence, since that's an area that we can really get into. One thing that is on your website is some studies, and I mentioned to you that I was going to bring up again the wonderful work of Stephen, spelled with a P-H, you know, Stephen, Schoenthaler, S-C-H-O-E-N-T-H-A-L-E-R. People can find him on my website under shows by guest on the tape list. His article was a 20-year study working both with prisoners and with students in schools, trying to address youth violence and behavior problems. What he basically did first was just to remove junk food from the cafeteria and stuff, just fake food. And then he went a step further and added in a one-a-day vitamin with no colorings in it, because some of the kids reacted to the colorings. And he saw the most remarkable changes in reduction of violence, behavior and mood disorders decreased, and IQ went up. And this was quite extraordinary. It was reported on in the February 2000 issue of the Journal of Alternative and Complementary Medicine. The if people go to the National Library of Medicine, you know, if you Google that, you can probably find the article. But the point is that there's ample research to indicate that there is a remarkable change when you add whole foods into kids' diets and remove junk foods, that violent incidents actually do go down. The question here is how to put enough pressure on the people who need to make the changes, and I'm wondering how that gets done in your experience.
Well, in my experience, it's best to really take a collaborative approach to making change, and by that I mean that it's important to try to engage the food service personnel. You know, they're working very hard. They feel they're doing their best for kids, and so it's important, ideally, to approach them first and see if they're amenable.
So are you approaching them, or are you training people in the community to approach them?
We're training people in the community to approach them. Some of our fellow steering committee members on the Strategic Alliance are. California Project Lean is a group that does that.
It's called Lean?
California Project Lean.
Yeah, in other words, lean, like lean on
them? Yeah, L-E-A. Yeah, that's it. That stands for Leaders Encouraging Activity and Nutrition.
Leaning on them. I like it.
Yeah. But they're, so just from the experience, because, you know, as I said, my role tends to be to work statewide and sort of bring the experience of those local groups to the state level. What we found is that it's working with the food service people. Also, there's now a great resource kit that's directed towards creating policies, getting the school board members on board. I mean, what it comes down to often is the disagreement about, well, is it whether or not schools are going to lose revenue. I mean, that is usually the first fear, and that's one of the main reasons why there's opposition from either the school administration, sometimes from the food service personnel, because they're afraid that they're going to lose revenue. But there's been enough changes made in enough schools that there's a pretty good track record that you don't have to lose revenue, particularly if you involve the kids in making changes. I mean, and that's another good way to get started, is to start a school nutrition committee and to, as a parent, I mean, parents can be the instigators for this. Sometimes it's a teacher. Sometimes it might even be the food service director, him or herself, wants to get this started. And then the group can really start to think about what they'd like to see instead at their school and to set some policies. And there's lots of models and standards. I mean, you can link to them through our website, our Strategic Alliance website, eatbettermovemore.org. You can go to
better say that again.
It's eatbettermovemore.org.
Great.
So that's another. So there's some resources there you can link to. But I think the basic process is the same. You know, it's getting agreement that something needs to change, getting the teachers, the parents, the administration, the food service managers involved. And as I said, the instigator could be any one of those.
My own experience is that parents often will literally drag a young person into my office to talk to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I usually ask the parent to leave. And I tell the kid that I don't have kids. I'm their parent's age, but I don't have kids, so they can really talk frankly. And it's a private conversation. I'll only tell their parents what they say it's okay to tell them. So kids sometimes will open up, but one thing I've noticed is that when I explain the science very simply, not in a, you know, not overwhelming them, but it's amazing how kids are interested in the science of what happens when you eat different foods. Like, okay, you know, you eat a lot of sugary foods. Well, so it raises your blood sugar. So what? What's the problem with that? Well, you raise your blood sugar, then your insulin levels goes up. So what? Well, the problem with insulin levels is it changes the way your sex hormones work. Oh. So it makes you break out, makes your hair greasy, you don't have periods if you're a girl, if you're a boy, it can affect, you know, lower your testosterone. Oh. So there's a way in which when you explain things to kids, like if you say, if you smoke, it's going to wreck your skin, you're going to look really old. Oh. So it's a question partially of getting the kids on board themselves. And also kids don't want to be chumps.
Right.
They don't like to feel manipulated. They already feel fairly helpless because they're kids. And if you tell them that they can make good decisions and that they have a choice in the way that their body develops and that it will make a difference, that they have some control, that they have some power, they often are very interested. That's what I found work. Another thing that I think we're talking about here is getting to the fundamental issues that affect health instead of falling back on genetics or lifestyle. So much of what's happening right now in terms of policy is that people are targeted for their genetics. You know, people say, oh, well, African Americans have a higher incidence of hypertension, so we should just slap them on drugs very young and we shouldn't try to, you know, influence the outcome by using. You know, I had a client come to me who had completely out of control hypertension and weighed 300 pounds. And I said, did your doctors ever tell you to lose weight? And he said, no. And I said, are you African American? It was on the phone. And he said, yes. So I said, well, you know, if you walk and you get some exercise and take a little magnesium at night, your blood pressure may drop. And it did when he started to lose weight. No one had discussed diet with him. In this case, a high protein, low carb diet worked really well for him. So there's a problem with people being blamed, the victim being blamed on the basis of genetics and that they're just lazy, they don't want to, you know, and no one bothers to explain these things. We need to take a short musical break. I'm Lena Berman, health educator Lena Berman. I'm on the phone with Leslie Michelson, who is the managing director of the Prevention Institute. Their website, preventioninstitute.org, has several links to lots of other places where you can find both research and community resources for people all over the country in their work. We're going to take a very brief musical break, and when we come back, we'll continue with this interview. Please stay with us.
The greener man will be far away from me, and my soul will be free, and they won't go when I go. Oh. Since my soul conceived all that I believe, the kingdom I
Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health educator Lena Berman, and I'm on the phone today with Leslie Michelson from the Prevention Institute in Oakland, California, a model for other community-based educational and organizing for prevention of illness in all sorts of different areas. Their website, again, is preventioninstitute.org. And if you miss parts of today's show and want to get a copy of this or any other in the series, Your Own Health and Fitness, you can either call the information number 24 hours at 707-874-2772, or you can go to the website yourownhealthandfitness.com, where you'll find information on the guests and links to their websites. So I left off talking about the difference between looking at people's genetics and lifestyle instead of looking at how they eat and whether they get to move, and talking about how your group helps people learn. We were talking about food in schools, which is a huge thing. There's lots of research that shows that this helps, along with Schoenthaler's. There was a research project that showed that when they put out a bowl of fruit where children could get it during the day, that they grabbed apples and ate them during the day instead of buying candy.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think that you make a good point, because another sort of false barrier to making these changes is people say, oh, the kids will never eat the food. But the experience has been, I mean, there's been some with salad bars, bringing in fresh, farm fresh food. The kids learn to love the food, and they particularly love it because it tastes good, and also because if they get the experience of going and visiting the farm and really learning about where food comes from, it all has an impact on how they view what's the best thing to be putting in their bodies.
So where are the other really important, what are the other really important ways that your group is getting involved in communities and helping them to change the quality of life in their actual environment? I mean, is there anything that can be done about getting people access to healthy food? You were talking about fruit baskets being delivered to your office, but what about the fact that you can buy drugs on your corner, but you can't buy a head of fresh lettuce anywhere in your neighborhood?
Well, Alameda County has actually home to quite a number of projects that are improving access to healthy food. In West Oakland, there's the People's Grocery that is actually driving a van around the neighborhood of West Oakland, and they have not only fresh produce but also organic goods on their dry goods on their van. There's actually been a really good project that the health department has been involved in, which is actually training small store owners who traditionally tend to rely more on, you know, high sugar and high fat snack foods for their income, to carry produce. And they've actually provided these store owners with some resources to help get the refrigeration they need.
Who's they?
They is the Alameda County Health Department. They have a staff person, or it's actually a consultant who used to be a produce vendor, who has gone in and done this training. In that case, it was really initiated by the county health department because they saw it as part of their role. They realized that their health education alone wasn't going to change behavior, and that they really needed to support food access efforts.
Hmm. Are you training people? So, well, clearly you are. You are training people in the community where you're trying to make a difference to do the work. Is that so?
Yeah. Well, again, I mean, I need to clarify a little bit about Prevention Institute, because we are the train the trainers. So we're not working directly with community residents. We are working with the community leaders who are making changes. So, for example, we worked in the city of Salinas with a community coalition focused on violence prevention, and we provided training, and the people on that PACT committee was the mayor and a local leading minister and some people running community-based organizations. And so we do the training with them to help them really institutionalize prevention as an approach. And that's how we felt we could have the greatest impact on changing attitudes. Because, frankly, I think our whole country has been influenced by the medical model. We tend to think about, what do you do once there's a problem? How do you treat it, as opposed to how do you prevent it? So we've really been working sort of with those community leaders to change their thinking about what they can do about prevention.
Well, we've also got the food industry stepping up and creating very inexpensive foods that are not actually made out of food substances.
Right.
You know, that are you can get 90 for 99 cents, and then you can supersize it. You can get something that actually is made from colors and on chemicals that are not normally found in nature, that are designed, put together so that they increase your hunger. And make you crave them. That's an enormous challenge. Are you guys addressing the food industry challenge?
The way we've been addressing it so far is basically by trying to get these products out of the schools. But mm-hmm. I do think we're ready to think about ratcheting up the work to another level. And I think that's by taking a stand on what healthy food is about and promoting. I mean, my work with Healthcare Without Harm is basically talking with people running hospitals and hospital food service about making sure that hospital food really reflects good nutrition. And I have to say that that there are some hospitals starting to step up. I mean, there's actually a facility in Santa Cruz, a Sutter Hospital. It's a small 30-bed facility that provides all organic meals to the women. It's an OBGYN facility who come there. And we're kind of taking that idea and going to other institutions, and this is just getting off the ground. So I can't tell you any success stories yet.
Can we boycott Jell-O? I mean, is that...
really?
And canned applesauce? Can we get rid of...
I think of it.
The amount of sugar in hospital food is staggering. I was visiting one of my parents in the hospital, and they were giving him supposedly a heart-healthy diet, and it was the most staggering amount of sugar foods I have ever, in various forms, I've ever seen. It was just shocking. I mean, there was no fat. You know, they thought that was a good thing, although maybe a little fat would have been a good idea at this point. The other thing I note is that both work sites, again, going back to fast food, but also hospital food, but old homes that care for the aged and nursing homes, the food is shocking is the only word I can think to use.
Well, and I mean, I agree with you, and at the same time want to acknowledge that I think it has to do with training and what have food service staff been taught to do, and that making change means
training the food staff.
Yeah, it does, and it means... And the managers, because they have to think about purchasing from different places. I mean, there's some of the farm-to-school programs. I mean, like the Santa Monica Unified School District was one of the first places to start a farmer's market salad bar program. And they literally, they got a grant to have a staff person whose job it was to contact local farmers and set up the purchasing arrangements. Now, once you get those things in place, they're easier to maintain, but there is sort of some startup costs, and they didn't know anything. They didn't know who the farmers were, so they had to find a group who could help them reach the farmers. And there are some steps you have to go through. And then, I mean, as you're pointing out quite well by describing the food, I think there's also a big thing about preparation and people learning to prepare fresh food again.
Yeah, I mean, here in California, it's not true across the country, but here in California, we have access to fresh vegetables that are really quite inexpensive right here.
Right.
And yet, every time I've eaten at a place where they take care of older people, you know, nursing homes or any of these places, they are always inevitably serving canned peas and carrots, which is hardly, almost not vegetable at this point, you know. And I'm thinking, this is California. So educating the providers is very interesting because, again, this goes back to how individuals who want to make changes or want to help, like let's say somebody wants to make a change in their own school lunch program or on behalf of their elderly parents or something, that there's an issue here with learning how to pressure the providers without alienating them. You want to talk about how you do this? I mean, I know that one of the issues is to show them that their bottom line doesn't have to be influenced by actually helping them make a plan, a meal with whole foods. Show them that a salad bar can have other things than iceberg lettuce and canned syrupy fruit, you know. So some
right.
of it's...
I mean, I think you actually kind of said it quite well. I mean, I do think that while you can do it as an individual, it's good to maybe find one or two other parents or another student who kind of shares your position so you have a little bit of a critical mass. And then set up a meeting with the food service director and find out, I think it is important to find out where that person is coming from. What are the challenges they're facing? What are they concerned about? When you mention changes, do you need to assuage their fears? I mean, a good example of that is Rodney Taylor, who was the food service manager at Santa Monica, and I've had some conversations with him, and he said, you know, basically a parent approached him and said, look, you know, I think these kids really need a salad bar, and I think you should get the food locally, not just get some commercial salad. And he basically said, you know, I didn't think this would ever, ever work. But he at least was willing to try it. And once he tried it and saw how enthusiastic the kids were, then he was willing to really make it a permanent part of his program and, in fact, became a great champion. So I think another thing you can do is that there are now enough examples, and again, I think our website is a good resource for linking to them, of where these programs have been successful. And I think there's even, chances are, there might even be one within driving distance of where a particular school is located, so people can see, because there's nothing, seeing is believing. I mean, seeing kids eating the food and enjoying it, it will really help convince the food service managers they can make the change. The other part of it is helping them deal with the administrators and perhaps even the school board that may be setting some unrealistic requirements for the kind of profit center that food service should be. I mean, ironically, in schools, the food service is generally expected not only to pay for itself, but often to generate some revenue that can be applied to other aspects of the school. Well, given that there's such an important connection between nutrition and kids' success in school and being well-nourished, it seems like it's worth an investment that if the school food service can break even, that should certainly be enough of a contribution to the learning environment of the school.
Well, and in populations at risk, there are some children who should be allowed to eat for free, I think.
Yeah, and I mean, that's another thing that is that...
Because sometimes that's the only meal.
That's right. I mean, I agree. And in fact, there is reimbursement from the federal government for school meals for kids whose incomes fall, you know, below poverty or even a little bit above poverty. I mean, the schools can get those meals fully reimbursed, and both for breakfast and lunch, and some schools are not actually taking advantage of that program. And I think it's to make sure those kids are well-nourished, they really should be offering both breakfast and lunch.
Well, I mean, there's also just, we're I think, still subsidizing farmers in this country, and there are farming communities peppered throughout the United States that can offer some kind of direct program directly to the schools. I mean, there's a project, of course, also in Berkeley, California, which is a beacon of, you know, sort of progressive activity, but with Alice Waters, with a garden that they're doing at a school where the kids are actually raising their own foods and eating them. So, we're living in a place where food is reasonably plentiful. This is not Darfur, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I don't completely understand why this is not being used more aggressively. And again, I think that it's a problem of the food industry's seduction and hold on people. Incidentally, you're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm on the phone with Leslie Michelson from the Prevention Institute, their website, theprevencioninstitute.org. again, you know, this is also an issue that affects food sites, people who have to quickly eat something for lunch, you know, having access to good foods in neighborhoods, having more than just fast foods and liquor stores. Tell me about some of your other successes in these areas. Tell me about some of the things that you've done or some of the research that you've done that, that have been sort of success stories to encourage us along.
Well, I mean, one of the things we were really interested in is there's been a lot of talk, at least I should say, in public health circles about the impact of the built environment on health and particularly the impact of community design and physical activity levels. But a lot of that conversation has been about the situation in suburbs. And yet it's clear, as we've been discussing, that that safety and access is perhaps even of greater importance in communities where people have limited resources. So we developed a set of profiles. We call them built environment and health, 11 profiles of community transformation, and those are available right on our website, where we looked around the country and found communities that had made changes that would improve access to either physical activity or food, or in, there was one that was a gardening project that dealt with lead and getting lead out of the soil, and that was in Boston. And I think these stories are really tremendous. I mean, one of my favorite, because I think it's unusual, has to do with the Boyle Heights neighborhood of East Los Angeles. They really didn't have any open space in their neighborhood except the local cemetery. And some people would kind of walk around the outside of the cemetery, but it was like an old cemetery, and the tree roots were coming up through the sidewalk, and it was hard for people to get across it. And so some of the neighborhood residents said, hey, let's get a rubberized path built around this cemetery. And they actually went, they were lucky because one of their members worked for the Metropolitan Transit Authority, so he really knew how to access some funding, and they also went to their district, their city council member, and got his support, so they were able to get the resources to do this. And this was a, at some level, a small change. It wasn't an expensive change, but it made a tremendous difference because once they got a rubberized path, then women with strollers could walk over it. More senior people who, you know, were more likely to fall could feel comfortable walking around it. And it's become also a social place. And of course, we know that having social support and gathering, feeling that sense of community is another important thing that influences health outcomes.
But what do you do if you have a neighborhood where there's a high crime, where children are at risk of being shot?
I think that there's a short and a long-term solution to that. The short-term solution to that is to really organize to get some places in the neighborhood well-policed so the kids can go out.
By who is it policed?
By the local police department.
And
I mean,
what if,
in other words, the community, the neighbors need to get together and they need to go to their, they need to go to the police department, and they may, in fact, probably they're going to have more impact if they also get their city council member involved to get that support and say, you know, we need a safe place in this neighborhood. I mean, there's an example in, that I read actually just about in the newspaper in Hunter's Point of a playground where gang members stay away from that place, so that's one safe place that kids can come and play. And it was really, that happened because they respected the community activist who oversees that space. But then there's a longer-term solution, which has to do with looking at what are the root causes of violence in the neighborhood. And usually it's linked to a lack of hope and sense of opportunity.
Yeah.
And so that really means looking at, again, I think you can do things like create a mentoring program so youth have adults they can talk to and feel supported by, and making sure that working hard on the education system. The city of Salinas, one of the priorities they set in their youth violence prevention plan was working on literacy. And they not only were getting kids engaged in literacy classes, but also a lot of the parents they found were not literate. So they started off expanding the amount of literacy education that was available. Another thing they promoted, and I think they're a good example, is they got local businesses to agree to let parents get the day off to come to the first day of school. Because what they wanted to do, their slogan was that they wanted to create a community of caring, that they felt that was the secret to reducing the violence, the violence that was being perpetrated by youth against each other.
Do you find that it's difficult to motivate certain communities because there's such a degree of hopelessness and people are working so hard to just survive that they just don't want to hear this? I mean, do you find that there's always some community activism going on and that if you plug in and give them the resources that it kind of moves along? Is that your experience?
Yeah, because I think what it is that communities are not monolithic. So I think that there's definitely people who their lives are too chaotic. There is too much stress in their life for them to maybe feel that they can take the time to go to community. I mean, because that's what this comes down to. It's going to community meetings. It's writing letters to your council member or making phone calls. But there always are some people ready to be engaged. I mean, I actually worked as a neighborhood organizer in Philadelphia going door-to-door, and that was exactly how we worked. We went door-to-door, and we found the people who were ready to do something, and we pulled them together into a group. So I actually think there's always potential. And I do think that even the people who are under a lot of pressure, often if they get involved, even if their life situation doesn't change dramatically, the fact that they're taking action, they feel more empowered.
You bet.
They feel better.
Well, and in fact, the research shows that if you do something about your situation, that your cortisol levels, which are your stress hormones, which can cause a cascade of effects on your other hormones that are destructive and can cause heart problems and things, that when you get involved, your cortisol levels start to drop. I mean, just the act of engagement with other people, the feeling of some sense of involvement, even small steps toward doing something. I mean, you and I talked a bit about, you know, in terms of this issue of people who are listening, maybe wanting to do something. And we said, well, look, you know, I said, remember the tuna boycott, how powerful it is when consumers vote with their dollars, how powerful that is, you know, and how much we see certain stores bending reluctantly, but bending to what their consumers are asking for because they need to make a living, and people having the courage to step forward, and that actually trying to make policies change is a slow, sluggish process. But if you just go to your grocer and say, I want some organic produce in the store, I want access to fresh lettuce other than iceberg lettuce, you know, and I want these things. I don't want just candy in the store, and I want organics, that's a lot faster in terms of making changes.
Right. I think generally starting with whatever your own community is, be it or the place you spend time, the institutions where you spend time, be it a workplace or a faith or organization you go to, that's where you can start making some change. In terms of the food industry, I do just want to add one item that we haven't addressed yet because it's not directly about food access, but I think it really is important, and that is doing something about marketing, and particularly the marketing aimed at children. And what's exciting now is that I was part of a national advisory group to the Center for Science and the Public Interest, and we developed what we call guidelines for responsible marketing to children. Now, let me say that we are putting this out first as potentially something to ask supermarkets to abide by, you know, things like not having candy at the checkout counters, not having all those unhealthy, enticing cereals at children's eye level.
Oh, thank you.
So those are some, you know, specific actions that stores can take today. Ultimately, I believe there needs to be policy on this in this country, but I think we're only going to be able to build to get policy, you know, that sets limits on how much kids can be bombarded with messages for unhealthy foods and unhealthy behaviors. I think before we can get to the policy level, we need to have more community activism just saying, no, you know, we're tired of this. We're tired of the fact that the food industry does research to figure out how to create ads that will get kids to pester their parents to buy certain products.
It's very important to remember that children do things by example. They certainly are influenced by advertising, but they are more influenced by what their parents do. And, you know, so what I would say to parents is if they see you having a snack of an apple or a handful of freshly roasted nuts that they bought, or choosing organic foods when they can afford it or whatever, then children will emulate that. They'll copy what their adults are doing. And also they'll respond to what's... I talk to parents all the time, and I know that some parents don't have any junk food in the house, and they eat this way, and the kids don't... They'll have a small piece of candy, and that's it. They don't want any more. They don't nag. I think that the problem with candy is that there's a kind of, there's a reward system with candy. If you're a good girl, I'll give you this, or a good boy, I'll give you this. And then if the kid reaches for it on their own, they get spanked. So there's this terrible psychotic creating dynamic that occurs with this reward business. And I don't think food should be a reward. I don't think it should be love. It should be food and sustenance. The other thing is, I think that people are afraid of getting involved because they're afraid that if they bully, they'll be sticking up like the nail that sticks up too high and they'll get hammered down. So part of this, I think, is learning effective communication, but not backing down and apologizing when you ask for something. This is a hard lesson. It's taken me many years to just not apologize for asking for what I want. I can do it in a way that's not abrasive, but I don't back down and I don't apologize. And I think that that's the kind of communication that's needed in these community situations, don't you?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's, you don't want to burn bridges. I mean, you want to, but you do want to stand firm on what you think is, what you believe is right.
So what can our listeners do to help you guys? Is there anything that they can do to get involved?
Well, one great thing people could do is they could endorse our taking action recommendations, because this is actually our first time as the Strategic Alliance to ask for people across the strait to endorse something we've put forward, because we feel there's an incredible opportunity now. There's some great state officials in place that need some nudging to really put some good policy in place. Another important thing people can do is to let us know about what they're trying to do, be it in their school or be it in their neighborhood. We can help tie them into resources, and then we would like to get their stories and share them.
So how do you want them to contact you?
The best way to contact me is through my email, Leslie, L-E-S-L-I-E, @preventioninstitute.org.
And is there a link on the Prevention Institute website?
Yeah, there is, too. Okay. And actually the eatbettermovemore.org website also.
Thank you.
Those would be great.
Well, we have to leave it there. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today. You've been listening to Leslie Michelson. Thank you so much again for the interview, Leslie.
Thank you very much.
Okay. And I want to thank you all for listening. I'm Lena Berman. If you need more information, or if you want a cassette copy of this or any other in the series, Your Own Health and Fitness, you can call my information number 24 hours a day at 707-874-2772. For a list of other available shows or information about guests or the Progressive Health Observer newsletter, go to the website. It's yourownhealthandfitness.com. Your Own Health and Fitness is a joint production of Your Own Health and Fitness, 8.5x11 Productions, and KPFA-FM. The engineer for Your Own Health and Fitness is Eddie Pei. Remember, being informed not only protects your health, it protects your freedom.